Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, whenever you're listening, and welcome to Tri-State at the Plate. I'm your host, Andy Burdick, and at the controls is the headmaster of Hogwarts himself, Jason Ruggiero.
Good to be here.
Well, we're kind of by ourselves down in the studio today.
We got dangerous duo.
No one else to introduce, so let's start this off on a positive note.
Dr. Garrett out on the call.
He's on call. So Jonathan Sanchez didn't record an out against the Cardinals.
Here we go.
Last Friday, he did stay in the game long enough to surrender two homers before getting run by the home plate umpire Tim Timmons.
I thought that sentence was going to go, he did stay in the game long enough to get run by Tim Timmons. because really, if you looked at the line score, you wouldn't know if he was in the game long enough to get thrown out.
Well, see, here's the thing. I went to go see the movie 42 that Friday evening, and I got out, and I was kind of watching the updates on my phone in between, you know, trying not to be a jerk, because they give you the guilty...
You ignored the little kid, at the beginning about, please turn off your phone.
I kind of ignored it, yeah. So in between, I'm seeing, oh, the Pirates are down early already, and I knew Jonathan Sanchez was starting, so I get out of the movie, see the score, and I'm like, well, you know, it's the fourth inning. We're doing okay. It's like 4-0 or whatever it was. We're doing okay. Jonathan Sanchez hanging in there. Maybe he hasn't given up 18 runs, so that's good. And then I get home and I see, like, Jonathan Sanchez didn't record an out. So
yes.
As I'm watching the broadcast, I'm trying to piece everything together.
You're working backwards.
Yeah. I am. This is I'm Tarantino-ing this story for you. So get home, piece this together from the broadcast, and all of a sudden I realized that he got run out of the game.
Oh, he got
run. Because after the two home runs, he plunked, I think
it
was...
Carlos Carrasco.
Oh, he went all Carlos Carrasco on... who was it?
Oh.
Alan Craig? I think he plunked Alan Craig is who he hit.
I'll believe you.
And so they tossed him out right away. Like, no warnings, just you're out of here.
Russell Martin did not... he didn't go all AJ Ellis. He was like one step and he was in front of the guy.
And he was there. He's like, hey, go on to first. Take your base.
Now let's keep it under control.
Nothing to see here. And so as I finally like figured this out, so I pieced this whole story together. Starling Marte gets hit by who was throwing that night for Starling Marte gets hit. That was Lance Lynn. Lance Lynn was there. Starling Marte gets hit by Lance Lynn. And I learned this is not the first time that Lance Lynn hit Starling Marte in the game, but the second time that Lance Lynn hit Starling Marte in the game. No warnings, no ejection, no nothing. So Lance Lynn...
Well, there was a warning after Sanchez was thrown out, wasn't there?
I don't think there was. I don't know, because I didn't see that and I didn't hear it anywhere and I didn't read it.
How do you throw someone out of the game for hitting someone and not issue a warning, though?
They just tossed them. Because if there had been a warning, after you plunk Starling Marte twice...
Well, he should have been tossed anyway.
He should.
Whether there's a warning or not.
So now I'm running a little hot here. My blood pressure is probably a little higher than it needs to be. And Mitchell Boggs comes in the game. And he just drills some. Who did Mitchell Boggs drill? Mitchell Boggs drilled someone. No warnings. No ejections. No nothing. So I think it was Gabby Sanchez.
Yes.
So now we're at...
Yeah, but you know what? I saw Mitchell Boggs pitch last night. He has no control.
We're at, like, Jonathan Sanchez is the Greg Maddux of his era. We're at three batters. St. Louis has hit three of our batters. We've hit one. We're down two.
Well, you know, Chinsu Chu still has nightmares about Jonathan Sanchez.
his poor wrist. His wrist throbs every time Jonathan Sanchez steps on the mound.
He's a little
gun-shy. I just needed to get that off my chest, though. I
understand. I have nothing I can say, though.
I was running a little hot.
Except that I watched MLB Network later that night, and they recounted this several times, one of which were Harold Reynolds, who usually I am a big supporter of, was saying he was sick of people trying to make excuses like by the count or whatever, you're not throwing at someone, the ball slipped. He was kind of just in this, I don't care, quit hitting people. Like, you don't want to get thrown out of the game, quit hitting people. Which, you know... There's some merit to that argument, I guess. But I don't remember them ever discussing that any of the Pirates players had been hit. Yeah. I don't remember that at all.
They're just like, Jonathan Sanchez, what a jerk.
All they were focused on was whether Sanchez should have been thrown out.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure Dan Plesac didn't think Jonathan Sanchez should have been.
Why not a warning? why not a warning? I guess Tim Timmons' rationalization was he thought Sanchez was headhunting.
Well,
so
I wonder who was the umpire that threw Carrasco out.
I don't know. Maybe I'll Google it when.
Maybe Tim Timmons is like a little gun shy. You know? Like, maybe he just.
It's like the okay corral of
umpires. He's like, nope, you're done.
Anytime Jonathan Sanchez steps on the mound.
But then by the end of the game, when the Pirates guys are getting hit, maybe he's just like tired of it. Yeah. Like, whatever. You want to hit somebody, hit somebody.
It's just lawless now.
Yeah. This is crazy.
Whatever. All right. Enough about Jonathan Sanchez. Getting my blood boiling again.
Is he still
again.
On the team?
No, he's since been demoted.
That's what I thought.
Don't worry. We'll get to that. So today's show, it's going to be a kind of a quick one on our end, at least. We're going to start off talking about what's going on, the happenings in Cleveland. We will then hit up what's going on in Pittsburgh and their organizations and talk about the Seawolves after that. Finally, we will conclude the show with the second half of our Ben Jedlicek interview. Ben Jedlicek part deux, as it is known around here. So let's start it off with Jason and the Cleveland Indians. Jason, Cleveland seems to be playing a lot better as of late. What's one of the big contributing factors to this great play from the Indians?
Well, yeah, that's right. They have been playing a lot better. About the middle of April, they got swept by the Red Sox, and that was the end of a rough... Well, we look back now, we know it's the end of a rough patch. At the time, it was just a rough patch.
Just the rough patch.
It was the rough patch. They're 7-4 since getting swept by the Red Sox in the middle of April. And I was listening the other night to the radio broadcast, which... I think most Indians fans know, you know, Tom Hamilton does a superb job with the radio broadcast. I was listening to that, and he was saying that last Sunday they had a doubleheader against the Royals, and they got just lit up in the first half of that doubleheader. I think it was 9-0, I think. And he said he was in the locker room after that, and he said it was the quietest locker room he's ever been in since after game 7 of the 97 World Series.
Yikes.
Yeah. And he said, I know that sounds ridiculous. That was a World Series. He goes, that's how shocking it was when I walked in there. And he said, but it was quiet for a while. And then he said, two guys stood up and just said, that's it. Enough. We're not going to sit around here and sulk about this. I'm done. Like, let's go out there and let's start playing like we're totally capable of. You know, let's not sit in here and wallow in it. Let's go out there and get something done. We can change this. And those two guys were Nick Swisher and Mike Aviles. And Mike Aviles went out in the second half of the doubleheader that they won 10-3, I think, and had a career high 5 RBIs. So I just think that's an interesting story, you know, and we always talk about how this team maybe in the past didn't have a vocal leader like that, and we were hoping somebody like Swisher or like a Giambi, some of these veteran guys could be that, and this is an example of Swisher doing that along with Aviles. And he's the kind of guy that can push some of these younger guys, you know, for their playing time if they're not delivering. But the main reason that we're finally getting some wins is we're getting some starts, some quality starts. And not even from Justin Masterson. We rattled off 4 consecutive quality starts, I think. No, I don't think Trevor Bauer quite made a quality start because he didn't go 6 innings. But McAllister, Jimenez, and Kluber all had quality starts. And Bauer went 5 innings with 1 hit. And he did his typical now dancey do with the 6 walks.
Still keeping it exciting.
Still keeping it exciting, yeah. But we're finally getting some quality starts from our pitchers, and that's really, you know, that's giving the offense a chance to breathe a little, I think. Like, these guys aren't feeling like, man, we got to make up 5-6 runs here, like right out of the gate. I think I saw a stat the other day that they're 10-2 when they score first. You know, and I think that might have to do with some of these guys who are struggling, and when then you're already behind, it puts even more pressure on them to deliver. You know, you get up there and it's like, I've got to come through here. And when you're up, I think that eases up a little, and a guy like Cabrera, who came alive on that road trip, has a chance to ease into things, you know, and become a little more not trying to pull everything, not always trying to hit a home run, just put the ball in play and kind of keep the line going. And that's what we've seen more in the last week. Guys just do their part and keep the line moving instead of trying to do everything themselves. And of course, Ryan Rayburn
has been. Is it too early to call him MVP Ryan Rayburn? Because
I think it's too early.
Too soon.
I think he's 12 for 14 with four home runs.
I think Ruthian.
12 for 14 with four home runs and two doubles, maybe.
So is it safe to say that the offense is starting to click as well?
It is. A guy like Rayburn has helped. Cabrera coming alive on the road trip has helped. Kipnis is kind of starting to make better contact, although it's not what we used to see from Jason Kipnis, but it looks like maybe he's starting to turn the corner a little bit. He did hit a home run the other night. Drew Stubbs has played well in the absence of Michael Bourne, which is nice. And Yan Gomes is back on the team because Lou Marson went back on the DL with a shoulder strain, I think it was.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of guy that can really help this offense. And I think he's got two triples already this year. And you look at Yan Gomes, he's a prototypical catcher body. He's not getting triples because he's fast.
Yeah.
He's getting triples because he's mashing the ball into awkward corners and it takes forever for the fielder to track it down. You know, but it is – the offense has come alive, and we've seen some guys like Giambi and Reynolds – really hustling, just out hustling the other team, keeping this offense going, like Giambi sliding head first, Reynolds turning a routine ball to short into a double when Jimmy Rollins missed it. And I think they're kind of trying to set the tone on this team.
Now, what about Carlos Santana? Because he's had one of the hottest bats.
Carlos Santana is completely anchoring this offense right now, and that's why you didn't realize it quite so how important it was when Carlos Santana went out with that thumb injury, because he was a hot bat then. And thankfully he's come back and just kept it up. He's leading the major leagues with a .395 average and a .483 on base. And he's second only to Justin Upton with a .711 slugging.
Wow.
He's slugging .711.
I'd be happy if our shortstop had that OPS right now. That's
yeah, exactly.
He's got that slugging.
Yeah. He's just smacking the ball all over the place. And it's kind of, there was kind of this movement or this momentum, you know, why is Carlos Santana and Mark Reynolds batting so low in the order? And originally it was like, well, we're trying not to put pressure on them, you know, but it got to the point, it was like, okay, that's enough of that. Reynolds can hit fourth and Santana can hit fifth or whatever, you know. And they haven't stopped delivering. Dr. Garrett's not here. So the update on Michael Bourne is that he hopes to go on a rehab assignment this weekend. Originally they were saying Friday. Now they're kind of saying this weekend. Right. You know, it's one of those things though. Michael Bourne's been out and they are actually gaining ground. That's something this team could not have survived last year. You know, when you've already got Johnny Damon in your outfield and somebody gets hurt, that means you have to put somebody worse than Johnny Damon in your outfield.
Boy.
And right now, you know, we've got Stubbs and Brantley and Rayburn. Nick Swisher, I guess, has a little bit of shoulder soreness from, he's claiming it's from playing the outfield, throwing the ball that far. So they're kind of taking it easy with him. Hopefully he's going to start this weekend. The other injury news is Blake Wood is actually going to make a rehab starts, rehab appearances in Akron. He's coming off Tommy John, so I guess he'll take the full 30-day rehab assignment. But if he can come back, that makes our bullpen even more crowded, as we don't even have room for Nick Hagedorn to be in the bullpen right now, who's done nothing to show that he shouldn't be. As far as the minor leagues, I just want to talk about a couple guys. Chun Chen was named Indians Minor League Player of the Week and Eastern League Player of the Week. He hit .471 over that stretch with six doubles. He's got 16 walks to lead the Eastern League, and he's hitting .348 on the year. This is a guy who has no position. I will freely admit he has no position.
Now, isn't he? He's a middle infield type. Is that what?
No, he used to be a catcher.
Okay.
And they've converted him to first base, and now he seems to be just DHing. And so it's kind of, you know, that's great, but are you hitting enough to justify being a DH? And the problem was that last year his power just vanished. when they moved him to DH. So it was like, really, wow, what are we going to do with this guy? You know, the power seems to have come back. So we'll see what happens there. He's one that this is his third time in the Eastern League. So I would look to see what happens when he's promoted, to see if he can keep it up, because he's been around Akron for quite a while.
Yeah.
Francisco Lindor is just continuing to rake down in Carolina. He's got a 351, 425, 521 triple slash on the year. So already people are like, how much longer is he going to be in Carolina?
Oh, jeez.
How much longer is Lindor going to be in Carolina?
He's a teenager, folks. Let's calm it down. Actually, and it was neat because the other day I was listening to, I think it was the Fantasy Focus podcast, and they had Jim Callis, who is one of the editors for Baseball America, on there. And Callis was kind of talking about Lindor and how people like to comp him to Manny Machado, both really young,
right?
You know, shortstops, good body, stuff like that. And he said one of the big differences was Lindor has a glove right now that's just, it's a phenomenal glove. He said it could be the best glove in all of minor league baseball.
Right.
Whereas Machado is more known as just a stick type shortstop.
Right. And you already see with Machado this kind of like, well, maybe he should play third. Maybe he's not really a shortstop, and he can hit enough to justify playing third. You already start to see that. And what the Indians development people all say is, and what they've said right from the beginning, right as soon as they drafted him, is Lindor has the glove and the arm to stick at shortstop. Like, that's what they always thought set him apart from the other young middle infielders, is that, you know, they said there's not many guys when they're that young that you just know for a fact this kid can play shortstop in the major leagues.
Yeah.
So anything he does with his bat is just
gravy.
Just gravy. And the other name, the last guy, is Anthony Santander. This is a guy, is a really hot name coming into the season. He's only 18 years old. He's at Lake County. Lake County hasn't played that many games, and Santander kind of started the year as a reserve. So he's only got 11 bats, but he's gone 5-for-11. He's just looked phenomenal at the plate. And because of all the momentum that was behind him coming into the year, everybody's already kind of whispering, you know, about Santander taking over the number two position player ranking from Dorsey Paulino. Also, because Paulino's kind of had a slow start to the year. But that's a name that Indians fans should keep an eye on down at Lake County. And if you can go out to any of those games, Lake County has a really interesting outfield, along with a lot of other good players. But LeVon Washington is in the Lake County outfield, who's a guy that had a lot of athletic promise and kind of a down year last year, and he's been showing a lot of upside. So that'd be an entertaining crew to watch in the Lake County outfield.
And I know after our experience, we went to a couple Captains games last year. It's a great stadium to go to. They're very fan-friendly there. They actually, during one of the games, had ushers coming down the aisle with garbage bags to take your garbage from you. It was one of the coolest
things
I've ever seen.
They didn't want to clean it up later.
They didn't want, yeah. But it was a very proactive, neat thing that they did. And we got to go visit the radio booth there. It was a really cool stadium. Great staff there, great employees. Everybody was incredibly friendly that we encountered. So definitely get out to Lake County. You can go see a game there for $5.
Yeah.
And you're gonna see some good baseball. We went last year and saw Lindor and who's that outfielder that I liked?
I'm not sure about that.
Justin something? I don't know. But there was another good player down there that I enjoyed to watch as well. So that is it from Cleveland.
Oh, the only other thing is they just signed Ezekiel Carrera.
Oh,
off
Zeke.
Waivers.
Coming back.
To fill in this kind of Bourne Swisher vortex.
Time of transition.
Yeah. It's pretty much known all over Twitter whenever that it was posted that Carrera signed. The immediate follow was he will be DFA'd as soon as Bourne is available. But Zeke Carrera is back in Cleveland.
He's back, baby.
He's back.
He's back. Welcome back. Well, let's talk about what's going on in Pittsburgh, the goings-on. The Pirates just finished up a series with the Milwaukee Brewers, and things did not improve in Milwaukee.
The Brew Crew has the Buccos number.
I think it's since 2007, I'm fairly certain. They continue to repeat this. Pittsburgh going into the series was 7-44 in Milwaukee since 2007. And after the series, things didn't get any better. They're 8-46. in Milwaukee. Right, so we got one.
Hey, yeah.
Got one.
But you moved in the – didn't help the percentage at all.
No, right? Sure didn't. Sure didn't. Wandy got destroyed in his outing.
Yeah, I saw that. I wanted to rub that in because, you know, I've watched plenty of bad starts this year.
He looked visibly agitated on the mound. You could tell he was just getting frustrated. I think he felt some points maybe he wasn't getting calls that he thought he should get. He only lasted 3 2/3 inning. He surrendered 7 earned runs.
But in reality, isn't this just like a...
That's an adjustment, a return to the mean.
And
people
Wandy.
Really need to understand that his career ERA is 4.02. So his ERA going into that game was 1.66. That bumped it up to 3.91.
Right. That's closer to what you're going to get.
You know, you've got to expect bumps in the road like that. Maybe not 7 earned runs right. in 3 2/3 innings, but, you know, you've got to expect some starts. If you look at his track record in Pittsburgh after he came over in the trade last year, he gave up 3 earned runs, 4 earned runs, 4 earned runs, 5 earned runs. He's the type of pitcher he'll keep you in games. He's not, I guess I wouldn't say he's like an A.J. Burnett type where we get him and we expect A.J. Burnett to, hey, you're a veteran, you understand how to win when we need to win and do that. So, but he's still a good pitcher. He's a very good pitcher, especially for the Pirates. James McDonald's start didn't go well either.
Wait, we're talking about the Pirates, right? Not
yeah.
the Indians?
Oh, we're talking about the Pirates. Here's another start that didn't go well. And James McDonald hasn't looked good all
no,
year.
Sands,
I think he had one outing where he looked okay, but even then his command was spotty. But against the Brewers, there was a 6-pitch sequence where he threw inside to Norichika Aoki, actually over his head. And you could just tell, I mean, in the 6 pitches, it was boom, boom, boom. Aoki was on, and then he plunked Gene Segura after that. And you could tell it was just one of those moments where the wheels have fallen off.
Yeah, he just doesn't have it.
And I don't know how long they can keep running James McDonald out there. I'll be curious to see when some arms in the minors are healthy or ready, whether it's something that they explore looking to replace him.
Does he have
not.
Options, do you know?
I need to look that up and see if he has options left, if this is an option or not.
But it's kind of getting to the point. I'm not sure anyone would claim him.
Right. I don't.
Even if he didn't.
Maybe a move to the bullpen if he does have options. I'll have to go look at that and see. But you can't keep running him out there to give up.
Yeah.
You know, 6 walks in 3 innings and 5 earned runs. So, speaking of bad pitchers, Jonathan Sanchez, who we talked about earlier, was replaced by Brian Morris. Jonathan Sanchez was DFA'd, so
Shinsu Chu can sleep easy.
Yeah, what your wrist is safe now, Chu. Now, speaking of starting pitching, let's get to one of the strengths of this team, which has been the bullpen. I posted an article the other day on tsmbaseball.com talking about how relief pitching's really been one of the keys to the Pirates' success early on. And if you look at that, Pittsburgh currently leads the National League in games when relief pitchers recorded more than 3 outs with 26. The outs per game that are recorded in relief, they lead the league in that as well with 3.9. And pitches per game in relief appearance, they're at 21. Leading the league in all of those.
That's a lot for a relief experience.
Now, you know, like, the trend, it can't continue, obviously, but you're looking at some of these guys that were coming in relief, like Genmar Gomez would have to come in and throw 4 innings to
right.
bail out a starting pitcher.
So the numbers are skewed a little.
Right, which that'll come back, but they're still, you know, if they keep treating their bullpen like this, going to be in the upper
yeah.
the upper half of using their
can't
relief
continue.
Pitchers like that.
You could go to the 8-man bullpen like the Indians.
Oh, yeah.
I think right now, because they sent Hagedorn down for Bauer, and then they sent Bauer down for, well, Carrera, essentially. I think right now it's the only time all year they haven't had 8 men in the bullpen. But let me tell you what, man. It's been working out. It's kind of nice. There's always another arm out there.
I said we should just go to the Houston plan and just let everybody throw 65 pitches.
Well, you could do that, too.
So,
problem is that's not really working out for them.
Nope, not so much. Not so much.
That was a sad state of affairs when the Indians were playing the Astros there. It was in Houston. It just was a sad. It's just sad.
Everybody in the stands is sad. They're like,
it was just kind of like,
baseball.
Their manager, whose name, I'm sorry, I can't
Bo
remember.
Porter.
Bo Porter. He had a very sad look on his face.
Bo Porter just sits in that dugout looking stoic every time I see him.
Well, like, he's got to.
Yeah. How else are you going to react to this?
I mean, he had to have known. It's just kind of like one of those, I'm going to take this job and we're going to see what happens kind of deals.
I mean, there's nothing. You can't do anything bad there. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Like when
Justin Maxwell's like your number 3 or number 4 hitter.
Times are hard.
Yeah. You know, we were talking about catchers who are really on a hot streak at the plate. Russell Martin, he's been tearing it up at the plate.
Good old Russell Martin, named the National League Player of the Week on Monday. He finished the week hitting .375. He was 9 for 24. He led the senior circuit with 23 total bases and a .958 slugging percentage.
For the week.
Stick that in your ear, Carlos Santana.
That was for the week.
That was for the week. For the
That's crazy.
That's a good week. He had
a good week. All right.
He had a great week. And Russell Martin is demonstrating that's kind of what you get Russell Martin for. You get that extra pop. Although one thing that a lot of people aren't talking about is the great defense that comes along with Russell Martin. And he's already thrown out. I mean, if you go look it up, last year, Rod Barajas threw out 3 base runners. So I'm sure
he's already over 3.
I'm sure Russell Martin has probably tripled that by now. So, he's been great behind the plate. It's just been nice seeing him. He's made snap throws down to first base. And even when he's not getting guys, they're at least on first base having to go like, wow, I can't get too far off here.
Yeah.
Because that snap throw could be coming at any time. So that's nice to see.
AJ Burnett's got to be ready for that snap throw.
AJ Burnett just picked one out of the air. John Jay was stealing. Russell Martin was trying to throw out John Jay. AJ Burnett just sticks his glove out a la Manny Ramirez. Sorry. No throw to second base.
Nope.
Just give me the ball. Coming home.
Yep.
Sorry, Russell.
I'm not having this. I need just to focus right
none
now.
None of that. Yeah, if you haven't seen that, go YouTube that. Maybe I'll post it on the Twitter. You guys can go see the video. It makes you laugh. Just a couple other points. Jose Contreras was added to the 25-man roster 10 and a half months after the Tommy John surgery. I wish Dr. Garrett was here so I could talk about how soon his arm's going to fall off. Jared Hughes was optioned because Clint Hurdle said that he's having difficulty locating his sinker. Hurdle said that basically, they haven't seen the Jared Hughes of last year, the pitcher that everybody was used to seeing. And then down on the farm, Stolmy Pimentel threw another gem for the Altoona Curve against the Akron Arrows on Monday. He threw 7 innings, gave up 6 hits and a walk, and struck out 5. So far this season, he's given up 1 earned run in 30 and a third innings pitched. That is good for a .3 ERA if you're doing the math at home.
Whew. That's some tough math. Decimals.
Yeah, some decimals.
You're into decimals there.
Tyler Glasnow, he spun a gem for single A West Virginia against the Savannah Sand Gnats. One of my favorite minor league team names, by the way. The Sand Gnats. Whoa, watch out. The Sand Gnats are coming into town. That's
I have nothing to say to that.
What are you going to say about that? Those guys are really irritating and itchy. They're so itchy. Those itchy Sand Gnats. Over 5 innings, Glasnow gave up 2 hits and 2 walks. He struck out 7 and he lowered his season ERA to 1.08. And you might be interested to know about the goings-on in West Virginia.
No.
Stetson Alley mashed 2 homers.
No.
Finished the game with 5 RBIs that same game. The downside, and I will say there is a bit of a downside to his season.
Oh, tell me more.
Some of his downside. All 3 of his outs were strikeouts.
Something, that sounds about right.
Something to keep an eye on. He has 33 strikeouts and 110 plate appearances. That is a...
Wait, say that again?
If you want to do the math, you ready? 33 strikeouts and 110 plate appearances.
That's not good.
That is a 30% strikeout rate. So he's making some outs that are not productive outs, a lot of them. But I will say it's good to know that you have an area to improve on, making contact.
I guess.
On the year, though, Alley has a 409 on base percentage and a 660 slugging.
I am waiting for the wheels to come off.
He's like, He-Man, don't. That'll just crush my soul. It will crush my soul. We're getting some production out of this kid. Then the last thing I wanted to touch on with the Pirates was that, it's kind of on that point of Jim Callis being on the Fantasy Focus podcast. He was on there talking about how the Pittsburgh Pirates have this rule through their farm system. It's called the 30-pitch rule, where if you have an inning where you throw more than 30 pitches in an inning, you have to come out of the game after that inning. And when we were looking at all of Gerrit Cole's starts, the first couple starts were kind of alarming because we're like, oh, he's only throwing 2 innings, only 3 innings. What's going on with Gerrit Cole? Like, is he hurt or something? And there was no content on what was going on with Gerrit Cole. So it turns out in 3 of his first 4 starts, he was out with a 30-pitch rule by the 4th inning. So that's just kind of something to watch, and when you're wondering as a Pirates fan, when are they going to call him Gerrit Cole? Well, he can't survive in the majors
when he's throwing
with
30 pitch innings.
He's just not being effective. He's not locating with the command that you need him to. So that's just kind of one of the things to watch for with Gerrit Cole.
I could go on a soapbox about my feelings about that rule. I won't. Save that for another time.
We'll save that for maybe we'll do some research on it and see if there's any content out there. I'd be curious to see what other, because he said that a lot of teams use this strategy in their farm system. And he also mentioned that Pittsburgh kind of stretched the rule with Gerrit Cole, because in one game he did it in the first inning.
And well, that's what I was going to say.
Basically, they said,
you can set yourself up for a real problem there.
We're going to have to fudge this one, because yeah, we're not just pulling you after the first inning here, buddy.
I know the Indians aren't doing that with Trevor Bauer. He'd only have like two innings two innings to work the whole year. Actually, that's not true, because I think in the minor leagues, he only has like four walks all year, which is hilarious.
He's just dominating down there. You dominate with that fastball.
Yeah.
It's electric. It's electric.
I think there's still an amped up problem with Trevor Bauer in the major leagues a little bit.
You can't tell that he's got an amped up problem when he crow hops from the pitcher's mound and throws that ball 97 miles an hour to the catcher.
Maybe.
Little amped up problem. Well, before we get to the Ben Jedlicek interview part deux, we want to talk a little bit about the Erie Sea Wolves. Make sure we're keeping on track with that. Actually, I'll be attending a game this weekend. Fingers crossed. The Erie Sea Wolves start a series with the Altoona Curve this weekend. Tonight, Ethan Hollingsworth is on the mound for the Curve. Yes, that Ethan Hollingsworth, the one and only Ethan Hollingsworth. I have no idea who Ethan Hollingsworth is. He must be an organizational guy or something. And for the Seawolves tonight is TBD, Mr. TBD. That is
he starts all over the place.
He's got. I'm looking at a silhouette here. He's got a beautiful silhouette.
Yeah, I bet.
So Mr. TBD is on the mound for the Seawolves. In case you haven't caught in the sarcasm, that's to be determined. We're not sure who's throwing for the Seawolves tonight. And along with that, some of the hitters for the Seawolves have been tearing the cover off the ball. Two of my favorite guys that I wanted to keep an eye on with the Seawolves, Ramon Cabrera, who was brought over in the Andy Oliver trade with the Pittsburgh Pirates. Ramon Cabrera has been absolutely raking. And at the last game that I attended, it was great to watch his swing and to kind of break it down and to watch and know what you're looking for. He has such a compact swing and he has such quick hands. And he turns on that ball so quickly. There was a foul ball that he laced over our heads. We were in section 102 down by the first baseline. And he just, I mean, he pulled. I have no idea how he got his hands to the ball that quickly to pull the ball like he did. He only has 7 strikeouts, Ramon Cabrera, 11 walks on the year. And that's a big thing I look for, strikeout to walk. How productive are you being? Are you getting on base? And how many of those, you know, unproductive outs are you having with strikeouts? And I love that he's not striking out a lot, and he's, you know, walking more than he's striking out. And James McCann, Cabrera and McCann have kind of been swapping between the DH and the catching positions, and McCann's been raking for the Seawolves as well. So, like I said, they're starting a series with the Altoona Curve this weekend, 7:05 tonight at the UT. If you get a chance, get out there and go see it. It's some great baseball. We got tickets down the first baseline, I think, for $12. I mean, it's a great bargain. You get to go see some good baseball. So you get to see Ethan Hollingsworth tonight.
Yeah.
Worth the price of admission alone and TBD. So
two great starters.
Well, I think it's time for Ben Jedlicek part deux. So we're going to cut to the second part of our interview with Ben Jedlicek, and then we'll wrap this up right after that. I want to ask you about this too. There was a chapter in the Fielding Bible, that was one of my favorites. It was kind of like a hodgepodge of really neat stuff. It was titled 101 Things You Don't Know About Defense. And in it, you talk about catchers and blocking the plate. And a few weeks ago, we'd been talking about this because Lou Marson, the backup catcher for the Cleveland Indians, he just got steamrolled at home plate. I mean, it sent him to the DL. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was a pretty aggressive, violent hit. And so I guess overall, if you're looking at catchers blocking the plate, overall, is it worth it for a catcher to block the plate as far as the runs that it saves?
That's a good question. It's obviously a hot topic with the whole Posey injury as well, and how that sidelined him for so much a couple years ago. And, you know, considering the prospect stature that he had and the kind of hitter that he has become and was expected to become. You know, my general take, first of all, that chapter, let me just tell you where that came from, just so you know. That was, when we were putting together this book, we didn't originally have this chapter in there, but we said, you know, we've been digging through this data for I don't know how many hours and how many years, and here's a bunch of interesting things that we don't really know where to put them. And so we said, you know what, we could put them all in one little chapter and just call it 101 Things. So that was a fun chapter. I'm glad you enjoyed it. But that that particular item, I think, kind of highlights how often that blocking the plate actually makes an impact on the game. And it's not that often. It's a couple of plays per year at the most for an individual catcher. And, you know, that one play might, the difference between blocking the plate and not blocking the plate might make the difference of, you know, one run over the course of the year. He might be blocking the plate and the throw not get there in time, so they never would have gotten him anyways, and he might put himself in harm's way. And, I mean, if it's, so if this is one of your, you know, your leading catchers, he's a major offensive contributor and a great defensive catcher, it's probably not worth that one run to risk, you know, a major injury that could affect the guy the rest of his career. That being said, I also think we overblow the one or two examples where guys get steamrolled and they go on the DL, compared to all the times that catchers actually block the plate and nothing happens, right? You know, I do still think that that it's probably not worth putting yourself in harm's way for that one run. You know, it usually... usually that one run isn't going to make the difference in the game anyways.
Yeah, it better be a big run that you're trying to save if you're putting right. your career on the line.
Yeah, game 7 or something like that.
Get your money's worth out of it.
Right.
So with all this data that you guys have, how long does it take to collect data on a player to paint an accurate picture of their defensive ability?
It's a good question and a tough one. The tricky thing is I don't think there's any one answer. I think the more data you have, the better. And that's a simple answer, but I mean, that's really the truest answer. Some people will say, you know, 3 seasons. You can't really evaluate them until you have 3 seasons of the data. And I say, well, that's not really true. You take it more seriously when you have 3 seasons than you have when you have 2 seasons or you have 1 season or you have half a season. But it doesn't mean it's not telling you something. You know, the guys who, we've done a lot of studies of this, the guys who have a half a season, you know, let's say on July 1st, the run save leaders on July 1st tend to be the same guys who are the run save leaders from July 1st till the end of the year. It's just, you know, it does bear out. It's not that there's that much random noise or that much random variance. And I'll also say that I think our defensive metrics have gotten better. I mean, we've certainly measured this with our metric. That it's gotten more consistent and more predictable over time. And, you know, even on a play-by-play level, we see that it matches up fairly well with what you would intuitively think just when you're watching that play. And, you know, that doesn't mean it's necessarily the most precise, but, you know, another thing to kind of just keep in mind when you're using these defensive metrics is you have to know what the metric is measuring. It's not measuring necessarily how difficult a play it was for that guy given his starting position, because we don't have the location of everybody's starting position at this point in the evolution of the baseball data industry. We don't know where the guy started, so we don't know if he had to run 50 feet or maybe he was cheating that way 10 steps and or 10 feet, and so he only had to run 40 feet to get that ball. That's one of the things that causes a disconnect between what you see when you're watching the game live versus what the defensive metrics will see. So the positioning is, in effect, weighted the same as the guy's actual range and how much ground he covered on the play. So when you understand that, I think the defensive metrics on a smaller scale do tend to hold up and they match your intuition a lot better. But if you're looking to weight positioning less heavily, for instance, a lot of people say, well, we should take out where the guy's starting position was and just start from there. Well, that's not something we have the ability to do right now, first of all, but I think it's up to every individual person. I think positioning is part of skill and an individual player's skill. I know there's certain positioning that, you know, is prompted by coaches and things like that, but I mean, we see guys all the time who, you know, they used to say with Cal Ripken, he would cheat one way or the other, and that's what made him such a great defensive shortstop was that he had the intelligence and the instincts that helped him cover more ground than his just raw speed would. So I'm giving you a rambling non-answer to your question, but it's kind of a I really feel like that's the best way to answer that question is there's no clear-cut answer, and that's disappointing to some people, but the more the better. That's really what it boils down to.
Well, it's interesting, too, that you would bring up Cal Ripken because he was known for playing, you know, fantastic defense and, you know, being a very, I guess, heady kind of ball player. But, you know, he was also known for his stick. You know, obviously he was a great offensive player as well. So is there a point where a player demonstrates enough defensive value to make up for a lack of offensive production? Like the Pittsburgh Pirates this offseason, traded for John McDonald as kind of a bench glove almost. So does John McDonald's defensive ability make up for his inability to do anything at the plate?
You know, it can. It depends on how good they are in the field and how bad they are at the plate, really. and I think there's some good defensive metric or some good frameworks out there, such as wins above replacement, that do a good job of putting that all on the same scale. So if a guy is worth 20 runs above average as a fielder and he's 20 runs below average as a hitter, well, then that offsets each other and you've got yourself an average player, which has a lot of value, actually, you know, in the grand scheme of things. If everybody was an average player, then you could surround them, the superstars, with a bunch of average players and have a pretty successful team. It's those below average players, those replacement level guys, that'll get you when they're below average offensively and defensively, or when they're maybe they're above average defensively, but they're so bad at the plate that it's really just not worth it, or vice versa. Maybe they're okay offensively, they just play such atrocious defense, they're not worth running out there every day. So, you know, the general truth is still that offense, the range from the best offensive player to the worst offensive player, is a larger range than the best defensive player to the worst defensive player. But that varies from position by position, and that it varies from player to player, of course. So, you know, those frameworks, I think, putting everything on the same scale gives you a pretty good idea of exactly how much defense you need to compensate for offense, or vice versa.
Well, I'm kind of curious about this, too. Last August, you wrote an ESPN article about versatile players like Ben Zobrist and Martin Prado. Is there any way to measure the value of players like those two who can play multiple positions?
I'm sure there's a way. I don't know it. I'm sure there's ways you could try. It's really a tough question to try to answer, though, I think, because some of the impact you're not even going to see in his... You can try to measure some aspects of the impact, but you can't measure all of them very easily. For instance, I think I mentioned this in the article, if Ben Zobrist has the flexibility to play several positions, that allows Joe Maddon to put in platoons at other positions, right? So he might actually, let's say Matt Joyce is playing right field. Matt Joyce's numbers might actually be better because he's only facing the hitters that he's, you know, most appropriate to face. So he's only facing hitter or pitchers when he has the platoon advantage, because otherwise Ben Zobrist can play right field and somebody else can jump in at second base. So Matt Joyce's numbers are actually going to be boosted as a result of Ben Zobrist's flexibility. And that's something that, I mean, how can you just look at Ben Zobrist's numbers and measure that impact? I mean, that's really difficult, right? But not to mention just the roster flexibility and, well, maybe that enables the Rays to carry an extra reliever or an extra bat off the bench, and the value, the situational and strategic value of those. I think it also gets tougher because once you start talking about pinch hitters and relievers, you're putting them in situations where the leverage might be higher. And it might be a close game in the ninth inning, and that might give you a slight edge compared to your other options at that point in the game. And at that point in the game, it matters obviously more than it would in the first inning or the second inning or something like that, or a blowout game. So in addition to just the actual run, if you wanted to measure it in terms of runs or production or something like that, you'd also have to take into account the leverage of the situations that you would get those runs in. So it's a very difficult question. It's very hard to measure the full value of those guys. And I mean, the Rays have started to build a team of those guys, really. So I think they understand that there's a lot of value there.
I tell you what, when Ben Zobrist needs a new contract, he needs to put a call into you, because you need to be in that room, go ahead and recite all that to them and get him a couple extra $1 million on his next contract.
Yeah, and hopefully, I'm sure the Rays are probably just not, they probably understand all of this, but they're just not going to bring it up when they're negotiating.
Conveniently leave that out of the negotiation.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's talk about the Indians a little bit, because the Indians put together a really interesting outfield this spring training, and they went out and they got Michael Bourne and they acquired Drew Stubbs, and they already had Michael Brantley in the outfield. So basically they're running three center fielders out there in the outfield every night. And I guess I want to know, what is the impact of having three center fielders in your outfield as opposed to using a more traditional collection of, you know, your slower power hitting corner guys with the speedy center fielder who has to kind of pick up their slack?
You know, that's another great question. I think it depends on a case-by-case basis. I think you've got to look at a number of factors. I think you've got to look at the ballpark that they're playing in. And one example of maybe a center fielder playing a corner outfield position, well, he had Carl Crawford in Fenway Park, right? He, you know, had been playing left field, had been one of the stronger defensive outfielders, and you actually put him in a ballpark in Fenway where he wasn't able to take advantage of his speed and his range. And in fact, I think if you watch the game last night, he's still having trouble with balls over his head because he's afraid of running into the wall all the time, which I think was a fear that was just intensified by playing in front of the Green Monster on a regular basis. So, I mean, it could really backfire on you if you're not careful. But, you know, flip over to the other side of Fenway Park and see how J.D. Drew roamed right field for them and how deep that right center field gap is and how beneficial I think it kind of got overlooked a lot. By a lot of, let's say, Boston media who were focused on J.D. Drew and the injuries and the disappointment. But sometimes what gets overlooked is the fact that he was playing essentially a second center field for them, covering all that ground and doing a very good job at it. So, you know, back to the Indian situation, I think it can also depend on your pitching staff, right? If you've got a lot of outfield ground to cover and you've got a big fly ball pitching staff, well, you know, it would help a lot if you had a good outfield out there to track all those balls down, those line drives and those fly balls. But, you know, that may or may not be the case for certain pitchers there in Cleveland. You know, Masterson, obviously a ground ball guy, he's going to receive less of a benefit from that. And the ultimate danger, I think, too, is you want to put the guys where they can be leveraged to be the most beneficial to you. So what I mean by that is if you have a very rangy outfielder, you want to put him in a place where he's going to get the most balls, that he can take advantage of that. And if you're putting rangy outfielders, you know, because you already have a very good center fielder, Michael Bourne, you're putting rangy outfielders in the corners, I don't know that that's necessarily going to be the best way to get value out of, take advantage of their skill set, right? But, you know, it's a case by case. What's the alternative for the Angels, or not the Angels, for the Indians in the outfield at this point? Is it a platoon bat at the very best? The upside on the defensive end and ultimately, you know, helping the pitching staff is you could save maybe 40, 50, 60 runs a year if you put together something like what the Braves had in the outfield last year, centered around Michael Bourne. You could save a ton of runs that way, and it'll really, you know, save your pitching staff. It'll save your young pitcher's arms, for example, if you're tracking down, you're turning in extra base hits, you're turning those into flyouts, that's several fewer pitches that each young pitcher has to throw. So there's a lot of potential advantages to it, but it will, you know, it varies on a case-by-case basis as to the actual impact.
So if Ubaldo Jimenez has halfway decent numbers at the end of the season, I'm just going to assume he has to buy everyone in the outfield a Rolex. That's the lesson I've taken away from that.
Yeah, and you know, what's interesting is I think pitchers can adapt to the defense behind them too. With Ubaldo, when he was in Colorado, would rely on the ground ball because you didn't want the ball getting in the air there in Colorado, right? But in Cleveland, with an outfield behind him that's very strong, he might decide to take advantage of that and be a different pitcher. And whether that makes him better or worse is still to be determined. But it could have a good impact, could be a negative impact too if it screws him up in another way.
Yeah, don't even bring up Ubaldo around Indians fans right now. It is such a sore subject up here. So, are there any new cutting-edge metrics? You guys mentioned that you're constantly looking at different ways to analyze the games, and I kind of like that. I thought that was a kind of just like a neat little look into how you guys function there. You know, not only as a business, but just as baseball people. You know, you're looking for new ways to kind of determine value in baseball and evaluate players and what they're able to contribute. So are there any new, like, cutting edge metrics that fans of statistics might be interested in?
Well, you know, I think a lot of the data that we collect, I think a lot of the great statistics, there's a lot of great statistics being developed in places like fangraphs.com with the statistics that they continue to produce. And a lot of that, most of that at the major league level is based off of our information. So I think that's a great place to look for most of the cutting edge information. We're also continuing to track new information, as I said earlier and as you referenced. One thing that we kind of showcased on Stat of the Week today, or yesterday actually, statoftheweek.com if you're interested. We kind of talk about our catcher pop time data and pitcher delivery time data, and which we've started tracking the last couple of years, and how that impacts stolen base rates. And there's a clear trend. It makes intuitive sense, of course. The faster that the catcher and the pitcher are at getting the ball, if the pitcher can get the ball to home plate faster and the catcher can get the ball to second base faster after he receives it, you're more likely to get the guy help. You know, there's a lot more that goes into it than just that, but if we're tracking that data on a pretty comprehensive level now and providing that to certain clients. And so that's kind of a flavor of some of the things that we continue to track and find new ways to analyze baseball.
God, that's amazing. Now, there's a lot of minor league teams up here in this area. We have the Erie Seawolves, the Lake County Captains, Jamestown Jammers, a lot of teams like that. Is there a data collection system for players in the minor leagues?
We do a little bit in the minor leagues. It's mostly proprietary, or it's all entirely proprietary at this point. None of it's publicly available, but I think that's certainly an area that there's room for growth and further exploration. I think teams do a lot of this actually internally. I think there's just a lot less data available publicly for a number of reasons at the minor league level, usually because it's just harder to collect and more expensive to collect in a dollars and cents perspective. So if you're spending a lot of energy to collect it, you want to protect the value of that information and keep it to yourself if that's the case. And there's, you know, a number of different companies who can collect certain pieces of information at that level and provide that to major league teams. It's a very different model than what we have at the major league level, where you've got companies like ourselves collecting this kind of information and providing it both to the public and to teams and to media and different sources.
Now, this one isn't about defense, but I'm kind of curious because I heard this debate goes on all the time where you hear the metrics guys on one end and then you hear the traditional baseball guys on the other. And it actually came up because someone was talking about Joey Votto, and at the point in time where they were having the conversation, I think he'd hit maybe one home run since August of last year. But they were talking about how frequently he'd been walking. And the traditional baseball guy was saying, you know, Joey Votto needs to expand his strike zone. He needs to be more aggressive up there. He's in the middle of that order to hit the ball. And then the more statistically minded person, his argument was, you know, he's being just as valuable getting on base, providing the guys behind him an opportunity to drive in runs. You know, Brandon Phillips at that point, I think, had driven in maybe 19 runs or something along those lines. So just how valuable are walks from a sabermetric perspective?
You know, I think what's interesting about walks is that in and of themselves, they're not that valuable, but it depends on what you compare them to. So if you compare them to singles and doubles, they're obviously less valuable than singles and doubles. There's no extra base advancement opportunity for other runners. You know, it's worth getting on base and letting somebody else try to drive you in and not making outs. But on the other hand, the walks are they're certainly more valuable than outs. So if it's a choice between, well, you could be more patient and you could walk, or you can go after expand your zone a little bit and ground out a lot. Well, it's a simple solution there, right? Like, there's a simple answer. And so it's a trade-off. And I think it depends. Another anecdote that's kind of playing itself out right now is Adam Dunn in Chicago, where they've kind of, he's been quoted as saying things like, oh, he's going to try being more aggressive. And well, it's not really, it hasn't boosted his batting average, that's for sure. And he hasn't exactly been hitting, you know, the long ball either so far. And he's given up those walks and they've turned into fly balls and ground balls and strikeouts. So if that's the case, then it's not worth it. And so it can depend on the hitter, right? If you can adjust your approach as a hitter and make it productive, then that's a productive change for you. That's worth it. But it's really hard to know if that kind of mentality and that kind of adjustment is going to be worth it, except taking it on a case-by-case basis and even trying it, right? But the danger is, of course, if you're a patient guy and try to be more aggressive, you might end up turning those all into groundouts and giving up the walks. And then on the other side of things, if you're Vlad Guerrero or Jeff Francoeur, part of what makes you successful a lot of the time is because you take so many chances at knocking the ball and hitting it hard, hitting it a long ways. And if you tried to be more patient, are you taking those home runs and turning them into walks, or are you taking the groundouts and turning them into walks? And so that's the real challenge of it, right? And it's hard to tell how that's going to play out unless you try it, and it has potential to backfire. So walks are, of course, a good thing innately. They're a positive offensive event, but it really depends on what you're comparing it to.
Well, I want to kind of wrap up with this, because I'm always curious. You've given us a ton of information, and that's awesome. But I like to know, just like on a personal level, do you have any baseball heroes? And if you do, who are your kind of everybody had that player that they idolized growing up. Like who was that player for you?
Well, mine was Frank Thomas. It turns out, as I learned more about sabermetrics, my enthusiasm for Frank Thomas grew, because he was, of course, a very patient hitter as well. Obviously, didn't really contribute on the defensive end, but his patience. I mean, they said in the mid '90s, everybody would say he's probably the most feared hitter in the league, and that was really saying something at the time, because there were guys like Cal Ripken, and Ken Griffey Jr. was even the other big name that was hitting 50 home runs a year. And yet Frank Thomas was more feared than anybody, and he was patient enough to take the walk and then allow whoever was hitting behind him, whether it was Robin Ventura or Albert Bell or Julio Franco or Paul Konerko towards the end of his career, let those guys, Maglio Ordonez, drive him in. And that added, obviously, a tremendous amount of value. I'm a little afraid that with his Hall of Fame chances coming up in a year, I'm just fearful that he's going to go unappreciated, because his real prime in the mid-90s, we'll say, was he was so far, so productive during the mid-90s, but it was right before the real offensive explosion and the performance-enhancing drugs and all of that. So it would be really easy for us to lose perspective on how fantastic and how far above the field he was at that point in the mid-90s before everything else exploded. And of course, if there's any player from that era that avoided suspicion, Frank Thomas might have been one of those. And he was always very outspoken against performance-enhancing drugs. I agree with when Joe Posnanski writes about these sorts of things. He loves talking about Frank Thomas and how fantastic a player he was. So I really salivate over his articles there. And I'm really hopeful for his Hall of Fame chances, but also fearful at the same time.
Well, I tell you what, I'll be pulling for Frank Thomas next year when he's on that ballot, just for your mental well-being.
All right. Well, I appreciate it.
Well, listen, Ben, thanks a lot. We really, really appreciate you taking the time. You've given us a lot of your time, more than we could have hoped for. We really appreciate that over here.
No problem. It's an absolute pleasure. Thanks, guys.
So that, again, Ben Jedlovic, the VP of Product Development and Sales at Baseball Info Solutions. He's also the co-author of The Fielding Bible, Volume 3. You can get the electronic version, or you can buy the hard copy. And he's also a contributor at ESPN, so go check out his articles at ESPN. He's writing some fantastic stuff about the metrics out there. So thanks again to Ben. Again, we greatly appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
And that was part two of our interview with Ben Jedlovic. We'd like to thank Ben Jedlovic. That was a fantastic interview. That was one of the coolest things that I ever got to do, was to sit down and ask him questions, because it was just awesome to listen to him talk about baseball. I don't know how you felt being on the other end, just listening, not getting to ask, but it was so cool.
It was still interesting. It was riveting not to even ask a question, just to listen.
Just to be a part of it. And I was really, really nervous. I have to admit, I was really nervous getting ready to interview him, because that was like talking to Albert Einstein. He's like the Albert Einstein of baseball. What if I mess up and he thinks I'm an idiot? That was all I thought the whole time. And then about halfway through the interview, I'm like, I could ask this guy anything and he's going to have the answer. It was great. So again, a huge thanks to Ben Jedlovic. We really appreciate your time, and we hope that we have an opportunity to talk to you again later on this season. Well, that's going to wrap it up for today. We appreciate our listeners, and ask, if you're listening to us on iTunes, give us a rate and review. We'd appreciate that. That drives up our popularity. A big thanks to Jason Ruggiero today for being the co-pilot on this magical journey. If you want to check us out on the internet, you can at www.tsmbaseball.com. You can email us, tristatebb@tsmbaseball.com. You can follow us on the Twitter, @tristatebb. And check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/TSM Baseball. So for Jason Ruggiero and Ben Jedlovic again this week, this is Andy Burdick, and we'll look forward to talking to you next week.
want to challenge.